Hey everyone, it's Tanzina Vega back with you in the host chair this week. Did I miss anything?
The president must be held accountable. No one is above the law.
This was not swept under the rug.
The prosecutor was not pursuing corruption. That's why the entire West wanted him fired.
Much of the press is not only fake, it's corrupt.
Okay, and I will say to my colleagues sitting here, I think you're nuts.
You know, you've got an opinion, I got an opinion.
Impeachment for that?
This is a cover-up.
Don't worry, we'll get everyone caught up on the takeaway for Monday, September 30th, how the media is taking on impeachment. Plus, a discussion on when symbols and memes take on co-opted meanings and why the history of hate symbols has evolved so quickly. First up, how the media is covering impeachment. Last week, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi announced an official impeachment inquiry into President Donald Trump, following reports that he and his allies had pressured the Ukrainian government to investigate Vice President Joe Biden and his son Hunter. Almost immediately, Trump went on the defensive, turning to one of his go-to strategies, attacking the press.
Much of the press is not only fake, it's corrupt. These stories they write are corrupt. They're so wrong, and they know that.
The word impeachment has been on the lips of pundits and politicians alike throughout Trump's presidency, especially since the Democrats took control of the House in January. But Pelosi's announcement has put the political press corps into overdrive, and how they handle this story could very well shift the political calculus in the run-up to 2020. And that's if they can keep the public's trust. So far, the audience, well, they're not loving it. You didn't hold back when we asked you about it.
I think the media are doing an execrable job of covering U.S. politics. They allow themselves to completely be controlled by the consensus among the elites in this country instead of covering things that actually are important.
Much of the media has mistaken its role, serving as a spokesperson for DNC talking points instead of reporting facts.
Ever since newsrooms have had to become profit centers, the media has become just another form of entertainment, competing for ratings and advertisers.
The media is doing what it always does. It's a frenzy. But this is the new normal with the Trump administration. When we have extreme dysfunction at the top levels, the power-hungry, money-hungry machine, its infrastructure follows suit.
Margaret Sullivan is a media columnist at The Washington Post. Margaret, always great to have you on the show.
Thank you, Tanzina. Great to be with you.
And we're also joined by Brian Stelter, the host of Reliable Sources and CNN's chief media correspondent. Welcome to The Takeaway, Brian.
Thank you.
Brian, let's start with you. The pace of coverage that we saw last week, particularly in cable news, a lot of folks dedicated the bulk of the 24 hours to impeachment coverage. How useful is that technique?
I think that this is a crisis for the country, and there is a desire on the part of the audience to be able to hear every momentary update. There is news happening every hour on this story, thanks to the major papers and networks that are breaking a lot of news. But I think we live in a media world that it's whatever you want it to be. It's an incredible buffet where you can have a healthy diet, or you can stuff yourself with junk food, or you can come away with a sugar high. It's on the onus for consumers more and more to choose that diet. I understand that can be frustrating, but I think that's the reality of this internet age.
And, I mean, do you believe that there can be, based on that analogy, do you think people can get news fatigue? I mean, I'll just say I was vacation and I was watching it and it was in the background for 8 hours straight. And I thought, I'm sure most people aren't watching 8 hours of this, but what do you think?
I think Trump fatigue is very real and it has been measurable for the past few months, especially in the wake of Robert Mueller's report. Cable news ratings have been weaker than usual. Traffic's been down for news websites. That has all changed now. Impeachment on the table means there is increased interest and increased concern. No one knows how this is going to go. In fact, I think that's the number one rule of thumb talking about this story. Anybody who tells you what's going to happen, don't believe them. Nobody knows how this is going to end.
Literally, it's a play-by-play. Margaret, what have you been seeing in the coverage? I mean, are you seeing any major themes in terms of how outlets are framing and covering the impeachment story?
Well, for one thing, we're seeing a lot of coverage, and it's really been very notable. For example, last week, all three broadcast networks went to coverage of the hearings and also Trump's own press conference. Mm-hmm. I mean, people are being certainly getting a lot of exposure to this story. So a lot of it. And I think also I'm seeing really strong pushback from some anchors and interviewers who are interviewing people who they don't think are presenting the facts, and they're getting pretty strong about it.
I want to talk about that pushback on the Sunday talk shows, because the hosts, as you said, Margaret, they were trying to push back against false or misleading claims. Let's hear a taste of some of that pushback.
There's two issues that were brought up on the phone call.
I'm not asking two issues. Why did he do it?
Chris, I understand that you have your question. I have my answer. There's two issues that were brought up on the phone call.
You have your non-answer
you
at this point.
You would be more sensitive about throwing out wild allegations against people.
I'm not throwing out wild. I'm throwing out the facts.
Prosecutor was not pursuing
to
corruption.
The president, based upon a phone call that the speaker never even heard.
Mr. Leader, with great respect to you, and I apologize for interrupting, but these are the White House talking points that were emailed to the Congress earlier this week.
Please
let me talk.
Will you do a favor? I'm laying out the facts here.
No, you're not.
You're making an argument. The repeated reference to Joe Biden.
Here's
all those things
Joe
are laid
Biden
out here. The fact that the attorney general was brought up.
You know, you've got an opinion, I got an opinion. You got me on the show, tell me what I think.
So a pretty contentious Sunday, Margaret. Your thoughts, and Brian, I want to get your thoughts as well.
I mean, I would like to react to this as a viewer as well, as sort of a news consumer, and that is that I really don't like the tone of these interviews. I mean, I think it's good and important that the interviewers, the journalists, are pushing back. They must, but the sort of shouting over each other, you know, I don't know why the thought is that that's, you know, makes for good TV or makes for a good democracy.
So, Brian, I guess the question there then is like, should outlets be booking folks who are going to, you know, force journalists almost to have to argue with them when they're giving out talking points?
Well, I do believe we need to hear the perspective of Trump supporters and understand where that support is coming from. I had Christopher Ruddy on Reliable Sources on Sunday, and at one point he said that President Trump's approval ratings are quite strong. I had to interrupt and say they are historically low. Those kinds of fact checks are necessary, but it does create a sense of hostility or a sense of challenging. I think the press has to be careful not to advocate for an outcome in this impeachment inquiry, but we have to advocate for a well-informed public. And I think that's what these interviews are about. We have to advocate for facts because, frankly, Trump's reality distortion field is being tested like it's never been tested before. This is the ultimate test of his ability to lie and manipulate. I don't know, again, what that outcome is going to be, but it's being tested. And these interviews, you see that because you have these right-wing guests and you have these Republican congressmen coming up with absolute distortions. And it's incumbent on the anchors to push back. But I also think it's valuable on one level for the viewers to see the distortions, to understand what those talking points are like, to understand that, yes, tens of millions of people are being told that this whistleblower is actually a spy. Now, that's dangerous and ridiculous, but they are being told that every day on Fox. And I think it's important to recognize that that's the playing field we are all on.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that, too, because a lot of political journalism, and including cable news, is criticized for being too focused on the theatrics surrounding the Trump White House. But let's be clear. I mean, a lot of the administration itself is theatrical, right? The firings, the tweets, you know, the bombast behind it. And so is it the administration? Is it the press coverage? Is there a balance here that we should strike, Mark? What do you think?
Well, I think it is a very chaotic situation, and you can't present it as being kind of calm and collected and everything like that. You have to represent reality. And at the same time, we have to really be careful that we don't get distracted by, you know, every tweet, every, you know, attempt to take us in another direction. And I think we have to stay focused on, as Brian says, the facts, which has been, you know, from the very beginning of the Trump administration, you know, an issue. The very first Sean Spicer briefing was full of lies about the inaugural crowd, and it's been pretty constant ever since then. So, you know, that's a factor.
I think we have to keep it up. We have to keep reminding the audience that we are up against the situation where there is official deception going on, official disinformation, the likes of which we have not seen in modern politics. It's uncomfortable. It's disappointing. You know, we should be able to rely on the administration for accurate information, even if it's spun in a certain direction, but we can't. And I think it is a challenge for all of us in this room and as well as for all of our listeners to be able to keep up with it. It's Monday morning, and on Friday, the Washington Post came out with a story that said that Trump, in the Oval Office in 2017, told the Russians, I'm not concerned about Russian interference because the U.S. does the same in other countries. That is a shocking, appalling development that happened 2 years ago that we didn't know until now, and I totally forgot to mention it over the weekend on CNN. You know, there's so much happening all at once that it is I feel like it's a tidal wave for the audience.
And it's a tidal wave for journalists too, right? Yeah. Because, you know, one of the things that right after the impeachment inquiry was announced, after Pelosi's announcement, the New York Times published details about the whistleblower that would potentially make that person a target for retribution. The executive editor of the Times, Dean Baquet, responded saying that they published the story so that readers could make up their own mind as to whether or not the whistleblower was credible. Margaret, was the Times, you were formerly the ombudsman at the New York Times, public editor at the Times, would you assess this as irresponsible?
No, I don't think it was irresponsible. I don't know that I would have made that precise decision. I was the editor of a newspaper for 13 years, and I'll tell you that you have to make decisions quickly, and some of them are somewhat questionable, and some of them turn out to be great. There's a lot of pressure. There's competitive pressure. There's all kinds of things. So I understand the argument for doing exactly what they did. I think I probably would have been a little bit more cautious. And that seems to have been, I mean, I'm not a decision maker at The Washington Post, but there's been a little bit of a, you know, stepping back from what the Times did there. And I think that's where I would have been.
Brian, we look back to the playbook of 2016 and political coverage then. There was a lot of talk about false equivalence, right? If we say this person did this, we have to say this person did that. Do you feel that the press is stepping away from that false equivalence? I'm thinking specifically about how Joe Biden and his son are being framed. You know, if we talk about Ukraine, we have to talk about what Hunter Biden did. Like, are we sort of getting back into that false equivalence?
I think most newsrooms have learned those lessons and have taken those lessons to heart. I think we've seen from the CNNs and the Washington Posts of the world, a real effort to say, look, these allegations against the Bidens, they are sensational, but there's not evidence backing them up. In fact, there's a lot of evidence that counters the ridiculous assertions from Rudy Giuliani and President Trump. However, no matter how responsible these newsrooms are, no matter how many high-quality news outlets are out there, there's still going to be this information, kind of disinformation campaign from right-wing media. And I think we just have to recognize that that kind of false equivalency is going to be happening all the time on the Fox primetime. And that is President Trump's one of his strongest tools in his war chest right now.
Well, and we know that Joe Biden's campaign also said that folks should not even book Rudy Giuliani.
So seen that before. I've never seen a presidential campaign say, don't even put this person on TV. But that's because they recognize Rudy is so far beyond the norms of a television interview. He's willing to say anything, do anything to defend his client. He's just like President Trump in that respect. We are in uncharted territory.
And we saw a lot of that on Saturday Night Live, for anyone who missed it. Margaret, I want to talk about the coverage of the Democrats who changed their impeachment votes over the past few weeks and have sort of, quote unquote, broken the dam here. There were seven moderate Dems who wrote an op-ed together supporting impeachment. CNN did a story calling the group, who are white, by the way, the unlikely leaders because of this change. But where does this leave legislators of color who've been fighting for this since day one? And even Dan Rather tweeted last night, interestingly enough, that we should not ignore that.
Right. I thought that Dan Rather's tweet was very interesting, that when all is said and done and when history looks back on this, that the women and men of color who pushed for this will be viewed very, very favorably. And I think it's important to remember that there have been those who have been pushing for a much longer time. Now, it took a greater, larger group to sort of push it over the edge. And then, as Nancy Pelosi has said many times in the past few days, the facts changed as well. So that's, you know, that's a major factor.
Brian, you've seen the criticism of the story. I mean, do you think cable news outlets, including CNN, have missed a beat in covering the people who've been calling for impeachment? Have they framed them differently than they're framing the current impeachment debate?
I think this specific story was part of an ongoing series that Dana Bash has been doing called Badass Women of Washington that's been featuring a number of different lawmakers over time. It just happened this time to feature five of the seven writers of a recent op-ed. That op-ed did push things along. This was seven Congress representatives that came out and from districts that were seen as somewhat vulnerable who supported impeachment. But I do think it is important to recognize that there were impeachment calls from the very beginning of the Trump presidency. And I do think there were times along the way, the last 2.5 years, where those lawmakers were not taken seriously enough, where it was sometimes viewed as fringe or unrealistic or impossible. It's incredible how quickly this has all changed, right? You were saying you were on vacation last week. You were watching this happen in real time. There was a moment on Monday, a moment on Tuesday, where this entire terrain shifted. And I remember thinking to myself, I'm watching cable news. It looks like everything's the same, but the world has completely changed. And I think we have to recognize that and try to display that to our audience, to our listeners, to our viewers, to signal that this is a crisis moment for the country. We are going through a trauma as a country, and we don't know how it'll end.
And Margaret, you actually wrote about this in the Washington Post, about how this moment, this impeachment inquiry moment, and might actually give control of the news cycle back to the media.
I loved this column.
Tell us what you mean by that.
Well,
Have we lost it so far?
I think that in recent months and years that Donald Trump has become the de facto assignment editor for the media, that when he says jump, we tend to say how high. And as Brian says, it did seem to change in sort of a heartbeat. The emphasis has shifted away from that. He's very used to being able to control the narrative. He is the reality TV president and the TV president. And all of a sudden, TV is not helping him because there's a whole other story going on.
You know, I've learned to jump really high for the last couple of years. It is true. I mean, the president's tweets are news, and yet we have overreacted at times to what he is saying. I think the difference now is that there's an allegation of a cover-up, and cover-ups create more stories. Right. There's a sense of mystery, a sense of momentum. People want to know what else is possibly being covered up. They want to know who's going to come out and speak. There's a sense of urgency and a sense of momentum now that's different, that Trump can't control, because now it is the whistleblower and these anonymous officials who may have cooperated. That's now who has the power.
And, I mean, we can't talk about impeachment without talking about Watergate. We know that blaming the media was an effective strategy for Richard Nixon during the Watergate investigations. At one point, he even said that the media, quote, hates my guts with a passion. This is not a new strategy for Trump. But, Brian, is there anything different about this approach?
I think we should recognize that it's out of weakness, not strength. It's an attempt to destroy the credibility of the media for a moment just like this. He's been doing this for years in order to protect himself from a moment like this so that people will not believe the facts. Most Americans see right through it. That's what I always remind journalism students when we talk about the fake news attacks. Most Americans see right through these lies. However, he's changing his tone lately. He's getting more hateful, more dehumanizing in his language, and he's using the word corrupt a lot more often. I think he's projecting, because as journalists find evidence of corruption, he's saying we are the ones that are corrupt. Unfortunately, I just think this is going to get worse, Tanzina, before it gets better.
Margaret, going with the Watergate comparison, I mean, so much has changed between 1973 and today. I'm thinking specifically television news, but let's go back to Clinton. I mean, did that coverage, how different was that coverage from what we're seeing today?
Yeah, we always seem to think about Watergate when we think about how TV changed things. I mean, I just think it was those hearings really moved the country. And, you know, I suppose it will be up to the Democrats to see if they can use that kind of push or emphasis to really change people's minds. You know, and I'd like to just push back a little bit. I respect the people who you had on, the viewers' voices that you had on at the beginning criticizing the media. But I think the point needs to be made here that the news media, particularly the big news organizations, including the Washington Post, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, CNN, and others, have broken important stories here that are in the public's interest. And so to say, oh, the media is talking about, is picking up on DNC talking points, I find that really offensive. That's not what we're about. And we are an important part of how our democracy works. And I want to push back against that whenever I hear it.
Brian, we've got about a minute left. Is that one of the biggest challenges facing the media as we head into 2020, what Margaret just said?
We absolutely have to explain that we are not trying to take any side, not trying to pick up on anyone's talking points, but cover the entire story. And that includes right-wing spin and left-wing spin and everything in between. The one thing I heard from your listeners that I really appreciated, though, was this sense that we're all just obsessed with politics, all just obsessed with Trump. We have to, as consumers, I think, support news outlets that are doing the rest of the news, the rest of the work. Yes, if you watch CNN, including my program, you're going to see impeachment coverage wall to wall. And that makes sense, I think, for CNN. But it's important to look out for other news outlets that are covering other important issues that are being underserved. Look, when you have a White House in crisis, other stories do go undercovered. And so vote with your dollars, vote with your eyeballs, vote with your ears.
Support your local press in particular. Margaret Sullivan is a media columnist at The Washington Post. Brian Stelter is the host of Reliable Sources and CNN's chief media correspondent. Thanks to you both for being with us.
Thank you, Tanzina.
Thanks.
My name is Leo Collis, and I'm in Austin, Texas. The media, broadly speaking, as if it's a single entity, has enjoyed the acrimonious atmosphere of American politics. That's evidenced by its general lack of willpower to shut down false or factless arguments for the self-serving purpose of, quote, hearing all sides, end quote. Over time, that has elevated unsubstantiated or debunked ideas to a perceived perception of equivalency with more scientific or fact-based ideas.
My name is Nan Joy, and I'm calling from Seattle. The media is always looking for sensation. That's how Trump got elected. I want the media to not get so caught up in the moment, to take a deep breath and see what else is going on, to report more holistically rather than reactively.
This is Doug in Portland, Oregon. The most interesting question to me these days is, why are we such a divided citizenry? I would love to see stories that pierce or address the right-left and progressive-conservative bubbles.
Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE to comment on any story or give us your thoughts on any topic. Also, we're on Facebook and Twitter at The Takeaway. Let us know what you think, and thanks for listening.
The Anti-Defamation League has added 36 entries to its extensive catalog of extremist symbols. That's everything from racist hand signs and the Nazi swastika to, most recently, white supremacist and murderer Dylan Roof's bowl-shaped haircut.
Symbols just play a very important role in sharing ideas, potentially recruiting, and often can be weaponized to harass and intimidate.
That's Oren Siegel, director of ADL's Center on Extremism.
Every day we're coming across new language, new codes, new symbols that are used. And we use the hate symbols database to inform the public about what they need to know.
The ADL tracks extremist movements and individuals from across the ideological spectrum. And its database, which was first developed in 2000, now has over 200 symbols in its catalog.
The criteria that goes into our hate symbols database is the volume of usage by extremists and haters of specific symbols. Many of them are actually logos of extremist groups, tattoos, the slogans that they chant.
For more on these symbols, the list, and why it matters, I'm joined by Cynthia Miller Idris, a professor of sociology and education at American University, and Heidi Byrick, the director of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project. Thanks to you both for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Cynthia, the historical roots of these symbols, how did symbols of hate become a means for extremist groups to convey a certain message?
Well, symbols of hate have been used by extremist groups for decades. The Nazi Party was using runic symbols as some of their insignia, was using coded symbols like the number 88 to stand for the eighth letter of the alphabet for HH for Heil Hitler. So there's a long history of these kinds of symbols being used. I think what we're seeing now is kind of ramping up and an increase in the way in which they can be shared and rapidly evolve on social media.
And we've seen how some of these symbols have evolved over time. Here's what Oren Siegel from the ADL had to tell us.
Over the years, we have recognized that people are more likely in many ways to come across hate imagery and symbols on their phones or on their social media feeds rather than in the public.
Cynthia, with social media, has the nature of these symbols changed as well? I mean, are we seeing different things now?
I think we're seeing, we see the same kinds of coding happen with the alphanumeric codes, the substitution of numbers and letters of the alphabet for words and phrases. But because social media itself is such a visual medium, we're also seeing a much more rapid evolution of hateful symbols and cartoon-like images. So that you're not even seeing someone, you know, you're not only seeing someone reference something like Dylan Roof's haircut as a bowl cut, but also an actual kind of cartoon image of that haircut appear on various kinds of figures. And so the visual nature of it really does lend itself well to a different kind of evolution of the way that the symbols can reflect different kinds of hate.
Heidi, did you notice any trends in the symbols that were added this year? Anything that stood out to you?
Well, I think the biggest issue is really what Cynthia was just talking about, is that we have so many visual symbols. I think one particular symbol that really leapt out over the last few years was this Pepe the Frog cartoon image, right, of this green frog that became deeply interconnected with white supremacist memes and thinking. So it's the visualization that you have. I'd also say that things are evolving so rapidly. One of the things that the ADL added to its list was this OK symbol, which is a hand gesture that used to be considered somebody saying okay to something, and that white supremacists have sort of subverted and now use for their own purposes as a sort of sly signaling of their hateful beliefs.
I mean, let's talk a little bit about what it means to actually be on the list. I mean, is this really being used to track extremism, Heidi, or is it for public awareness? Like, what is the purpose of having a list like this?
Yeah, well, I'm very thankful to the ADL for having compiled this list, because for law enforcement in particular, they need to be able to decode the kinds of alphanumeric symbols that Cynthia was talking about, what they see, for example, visually depicted possibly at hate crime, where hate crimes have occurred. This kind of information is really, really important for white supremacists. It's also important for people who do research on the web about extremist movements, because they need to track these things over time, and that matters. And there's also the issue of when you're celebrating something like, for example, Dylann Roof's bowl cut, that is deeply connected to people who might be becoming radicalized online and on a pathway to violence. So you really need to know what these symbols are and be able to catch them to figure out what's happening out there with white supremacy.
Cynthia, how does something like a haircut in this case, the Dylann Roof bowl cut, become a hate symbol? I mean, could you not argue that there are people who are not white supremacists that have that similar haircut? Or, I mean, historically, have these things evolved in that way?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think part of the power of these symbols actually rests on their plausible deniability, meaning that a lot of people use, and the database makes that very clear in a lot of the entries, saying, you know, you have to proceed, any interpretation has to be done with caution. A lot of people use similar sorts of symbols for completely benign reasons, right? And so just because someone gives their kid a bowl cut doesn't mean, you know, of course, in any way that they are, you know, necessarily espousing or believing in any kind of white supremacist extremist beliefs. But when you have, you know, what you have are online kind of a valorization of Dylann Roof's act of terror and the murder of these, you know, innocent worshipers in a church with language like, you know, the bull gang, you know, to symbolize that they are joining, they're part of this, they're valorizing what he did. And so it becomes part of their kind of avatars or their screen names, and then they're sharing those kinds of bull cut images as well. So it's a whole series of memes related to him to celebrate that act. And I think that's the kind of the context in which, you know, parents or teachers or law enforcement could interpret the use of that meme or the use of something that along with something else that indicated kind of potentially hateful beliefs.
Cynthia, I want to talk about the context of these symbols and how we can sort of parse them apart. And again, I'm going to play a clip here from the ADL's Oren Siegel.
For every symbol that we have, it is underscored by the fundamental principle that context is key. So if you see somebody with a Pepe the Frog tattoo or somebody giving the OK symbol, context is needed in order to decide whether that is indeed there for the purposes of hate or whether OK is just OK.
Cynthia, how do you make that determination? How is someone supposed to determine that?
Well, one of the things I always tell is often, you know, I have students who will learn about the kind of work that I do, and then they feel like they're being detectives out on the street looking for somebody wearing a certain brand of sneakers or seeing a certain kind of T-shirt. And I always say, you know, first of all, a single symbol on its own is almost always meaningless unless it's something like the swastika or something very, very clear. But when you start to have multiple contextual clues and you're seeing a symbol in the context of a far-right rally or a march in Charlottesville or a flag being waved at that rally, that's where, you know, you have a context, you have actually a hateful event, you have a hateful set of things being said online, and then attached to that is also a set of alphanumeric symbols that are conveying something even more hateful. Those in those contexts, you know, when you have someone flashing the OK symbol, after having killed 51 people in Christchurch, you know, that kind of context makes it very clear. There are a lot of other settings where it's much less clear and you really can't interpret it in any particular way.
Is there a particular group of people who are most susceptible to being influenced by hate symbols, Cynthia?
I would say young people in general. I think one of the things that appeals to young people is the kind of game-playing nature of these symbols and the fact that I think a lot of times when you have coded symbols, it can give young people a sense of power and secrecy, and particularly against adults who might be trying to censor or suppress those in a ban, let's say in a school dress code. And so, you know, wearing something on a T-shirt or in a tattoo or just, you know, in a communication sometimes flashed on a in an avatar in a classroom, we've seen that where they use it as a username and they feel like, you know, hey, they're getting one over on adults who don't know what they're doing. And so I think that can be also be kind of a gateway into it. They're doing it because it's fun. And they're adapting these memes because they're fun and sharing them because they think they're funny. And then the ideological kind of content comes along later.
Heidi, there have been, we talk a lot about social media's role in all this, and I think there have been lots of photos where people are sort of assumed to be flashing the OK symbol, at least, you know, surreptitiously or not. Does this give clarity in any way to that? I mean, can we read into that and say, yes, the person at that congressional hearing, for example, was flashing a white supremacist symbol? Or should we be cautious in how we apply this new list to what we see on social media?
Well, I think you have to be extremely cautious. And this point about context really is everything. I mean, if you don't have indications that the person involved in flashing this sign perhaps has a history in white supremacist movement or extremist movements, you shouldn't ascribe those ideas directly to them. I've had quite a few calls from journalists yesterday saying, here's a person flashing an OK sign. Do you think that this is hate driven? And I've had to say over and over again, if we don't have any more information other than a person depicting this symbol, it is completely unreasonable to assume that they have anything to do with the hate movement or that their intent is to indicate something about white supremacy. So in general, you have to be very, very careful.
And Heidi, you were at a meeting just over a week ago when the Department of Homeland Security released a new strategy where they said they would start focusing on domestic terrorism and really honing in on the extreme right and white supremacist violence. Could the ADL database be useful in those approaches?
There's no question that it will be useful. I mean, this is one of the number one ways that white supremacists self-identify and express themselves. As Cynthia described a minute ago, they sort of like to have this coded language, this inside baseball. We're the ones who know what's going on. The outside world maybe doesn't. So one of the prime indicators, and this has been going on for years and years and years, are whether these symbols are being used. That tells you that white supremacists are gathering. And there's a reason that they're sometimes obscure. It gives that kind of inside baseball nature to the organizations. And I would expect that federal law enforcement will want to understand all of the things that are on the ADL's list, because that's going to be necessary as they go forward in trying to tackle rising white supremacist violence.
Well, and the DHS's overall strategy in terms of combating domestic terrorism has been kind of sporadic. The DHS had a website dedicated to its counterterrorism task force, but the task force itself doesn't exist anymore. I mean, what does that tell us?
Well, look, the DHS basically abandoned serious work on white supremacy about a decade ago. There's been this shift in the federal government after 9/11 for obvious reasons to focusing on terrorism that, you know, is related to Islamic extremism. Meanwhile, we had metastasizing white supremacist violence in this country, attacks like Dylann Roof's, attacks like in the Pittsburgh synagogue, what happened in El Paso. So they're going to have to really refocus their efforts, and they're going to have to staff up and train their people to identify this particular threat in a way that they just simply haven't been doing for a while. I mean, it's a good sign that they're taking it seriously. It's unfortunate that we've had all this violence without a good counter for a very, very long time. So at least the feds are on it now.
Cynthia, is it useful or effective to have an online database or a list of these symbols, and to whom?
Well, I think it's extremely useful. I think it's useful to several different kinds of groups. I mean, first of all, you know, one of the ways that they are escaping kind of algorithmic detection is by using coded symbols. So if those coded symbols become more readily apparent in terms of what their meaning is, then people can report, you know, hateful speech more easily to online companies, to social media companies, but also teachers, parents, local community leaders, law enforcement, mental health counselors, school counselors, anybody really who comes into contact with youth. When you are seeing these kinds of symbols, and as it, you know, they do show up, you know, even there'll be an arson, let's say there was, you know, in Tennessee recently, and then, you know, there was a white supremacist symbol that's on this database, you know, spray painted at the scene. And I think had that symbol not been used very recently by the Christchurch shooter on his gun, it might not have been as quickly recognized as it was. So having a database that makes it clear, something that people can turn to. I mean, there are also experts they can ask, but there's a lot of training up to do. There's a lot of catch up work to do, as Heidi was saying, given how far behind we are in paying attention to the threat. And so having a database as a place to start will certainly help.
And Heidi, just last question here. What about the role that tech companies can play? Should technology companies be using this ADL catalog to identify potential red flags?
I think the ADL's database is going to be extremely useful for tech companies going forward. There's now actually a consortium called the Global Internet Forum for Counterterrorism that has been used for a long time to identify Islamic extremist symbols and videos and remove them from the web worldwide. They're now going to use that same artificial intelligence system to target white supremacist activities, and the ADL's database gives them the images and the language that will allow them to root out and find white supremacist hate material as they develop these AI systems.
Heidi Byrick is the director of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project, and Cynthia Miller Idris is a professor of sociology at American University. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's all for us today. If you missed anything or you want to listen back, you can check out our podcast. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
I'm Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, our team has been reporting high-quality news about science, technology, and medicine. News you won't get anywhere else. And now that political news is 24/7, our audience is turning to us to know about the really important stuff in their lives. Cancer, climate change, genetic engineering, childhood diseases. Our sponsors know the value of science and health news. For more sponsorship information, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.